comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, ladies and gentlemen, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful planet we call home. Welcome to talk radio like nowhere else on earth. We're here because you have a right to know and because you matter. The Kevin Smith Show is a nightly excursion into the world of the strange and unexplained, and the world of the strange and unexplained is truly a worldwide thing. All around this planet, in every country, strange phenomena happens, and it's all worthy of discussion and investigation, and that's what we do here. Our weekly newsletter also deals with such strange and unexplained phenomena, and is yours for the incredibly high price of zero. That's right. It's absolutely free. So be sure that you subscribe right now if you're not already receiving it. Just go over to my website and click that big word right in the middle of your screen that says K-Files, and you can subscribe. My guest this evening is a world of strange and unexplained all to himself. He's very well known and a self-described crackpot historian and a 23rd degree Discordian. Adam Gorightly will join us on the other side of the break, so prepare to have your brain bent. The Kevin Smith Show is listener-supported. You hear me say that frequently. And many of you that hear me say that frequently, you hear it frequently because you love the show and you're here night after night. And yet, you haven't done anything to help us remain on the air. Let me encourage you to do something to help us remain on the air. Let me encourage you to either click the donate button and make a donation to the show, or join our members area. Now, the members area is also exorbitantly priced. It's 23 cents per day, $6.95. And in the members area are a lot of things you're missing right now. You're missing our forums. You're missing our chat room. You're missing having your own profile page, your own picture gallery, photo gallery, your own blog. You're missing that. You're missing being able to watch the show. And as you know, on a lot of the shows, the guest has provided us with photographs having to do with their research and their information. And on some of the shows where I have no guest, I present a lot of photos. You don't get to see those unless you are a member. If you are a member, then you do get to see them live on our private TV channel just for members. Now, you get all of that, and there's a lot more. I mean, there's the Video Galaxy. There's the library of free ebooks for you to download. Lots and lots of stuff in the members area. And it's yours, as I said, for the exorbitant sum of 23 cents per day. You can't buy anything for that, and yet here at the Kevin Smith Show, you get it all. So why not join right now? We'll be back with Adam Gorightly in just a bit. to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Adam Gorightly. His latest book is The Who's Who of the Manson Family, co-written with Seamus MacFarlane. And he is a self-described certified crackpot historian and 23rd degree Discordian, and has been chronicling the fringe and conspiracy culture in an illuminating manner for over two decades. He was an active contributor to the zine revolution in the late 80s and early 90s. His byline was a familiar sight in many cutting-edge magazines of the period where he sharpened his literary teeth. His articles have appeared in numerous publications such as The Excluded Middle, UFO Magazine, Paranoia, Steam Shovel Press, 424, and a few others. Adam Gorightly, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Hey, thanks, Kevin. Thanks for the warm welcome.
I want to tell people, because I think they should know, I want them to know, that you're a friend on Facebook.
Yes.
And I was going through this list of all these friends on Facebook, and seeing who all is there. And I remember when you requested to be a friend on Facebook, and I confirmed it, and then I forgot about it. And so I'm going through the list, and I get to your name, and the thought hit me, why haven't I asked Adam Gorightly to be a guest on the show? And so I got in touch with you, and here you are, and I appreciate you being here.
Yeah, thanks.
Adam, why do you say that you are a crackpot historian?
How did that get started? I think it came up, I wrote a blurb for my first book, The Shadow Over Santa Susana, Black Magic, Mind Control, and Manson Family Mythos is the long-winded title. And at that, there I described myself as a crackpot historian, kind of popped into my head. I think that I came up with that because in the intro you talked about, I wrote for a lot of zines back in the day, the late 80s, early 90s, and a lot of the articles I wrote were about colorful characters, such as, darker characters too, like Charles Manson, but more off-the-wall people like the Rainbow Man, Rock and Rollin' Stewart, who showed up at a bunch of sporting events back in the 70s, that guy with the tutti frutti rainbow wig. I don't know if you recall him.
Sure, sure.
Who eventually got into a siege, kidnapped some lady at a hotel near an airport, and ended up getting locked up. But I wrote about a lot of crazy characters like him and Carrie Thornley, who I ended up writing a book about. So I guess what I was saying, I was a historian writing about crackpots, but and some people might refer to me as a crackpot, so take
well,
the choice.
Okay, you also refer to yourself as a 23rd degree Discordian. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. I started for a while referring to myself as a 33rd degree Freemason on some of my books just to see what kind of reaction I would get from that, but I thought it wise to change that. And what Discordianism is, I deal with it quite a bit in my book on Carrie Thornley, who was the founder of this spoof religion, Discordianism, and we can get into more of that if you want later, but it's the worship of the Greek goddess of chaos and discord, Eris. And I am a card-carrying Discordian. Anybody can become a Discordian if they so wish. And the holy number, one of the holy numbers in Discordian is the number 23. So I'm a 23rd degree Discordian.
Okay.
If that makes any sense whatsoever.
Well, yeah. Within the context of the Gorightly world, it certainly does.
Okay.
But it's a spoof religion, right?
Well, it is a spoof religion, but Carrie Thornley maybe we should talk a bit about Kerry Thornley, and I can explain to you how it became more than a spoof religion to him and ended up really impacting his life in strange ways.
Sure.
Yeah. Thornley was born in the late 30s in Southern California, Whittier, California, in fact, the same town that gave us such renowned piano players as Tom Waits and Richard Milhouse Nixon. And in high school, he and a buddy of his by the name of Greg Hill had often met in bowling alleys and had long discussions. And the reason they chose bowling alleys was... they were able to buy beer there, so that kind of helped inspire their revelations. And they said at one of their long rambling sessions, they discovered they had a mystical vision about this religion, Discordianism. So they started this religion. You know, it was just an in-joke between the two kids back then. They were just getting out of high school. So shortly thereafter... Thornley enlisted in the Marines. He was had to fulfill his, he'd been in the reserve, so he was fulfilling his active duty. And in the Marines, he met none other than Lee Harvey Oswald. And in fact, was writing a book about Oswald 3 years before the Kennedy assassination, which was kind of another one of the first curiosities about Thornley. And eventually, he moved to New Orleans, and this was in 61 or so. After Oswald defected to Russia and came back, he was also in New Orleans, but Thornley never claimed that he saw Oswald in New Orleans during this period. Anyway, eventually, Jim Garrison... we're all familiar with Jim Garrison from the Oliver Stone's JFK movie, claimed that Thornley was involved in the JFK conspiracy, that he'd worked for the CIA, and that he was one of the Oswald doubles. Thornley, of course, denied all of this stuff for many, many years until the early 70s when he started having memories of some of the things in New Orleans he had forgotten about, and he came to believe he'd been brainwashed and was an MK-Ultra victim, the same as Oswald. And so one of the weird things about Discordianism, they had a Discordian branch in New Orleans during that period, and a lot of that material Jim Garrison later came across and became convinced that the Discordian Society, the spoof religion, was a front for the CIA. So, you know, the spoof religion that he cooked up kind of took on a life of its own, and, you know, this worship of the Greek goddess of chaos and discord maybe brought more chaos and discord in his life than he had bargained for.
I want to go back to something that you just mentioned. You said he was he met Oswald when he was in the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
And he was writing a book about him 3 years before the assassination, right?
Yeah, how that worked out, Thornley, this was like 59. He met Oswald at El Toro Marine Base in Southern California, and probably knew him for a couple months, and they had a lot of lengthy discussions about philosophy and politics, and they had kind of an affinity for each other on an intellectual level. So Thornley, at that time, Oswald had come back from Japan kind of under a cloud of disgrace. He'd been really demoted to like a private, and so he was kind of a black sheep of that outfit. Oswald had previously been at Atsugi Air Base in Japan. And so that's where Thornley got shipped to, and on his way over there to Japan, he started working on this novel, The Idle Warriors, which was kind of, the main character was a composite of a bunch of Marines he had known, one of them Lee Harvey Oswald. So he got over to Atsugi and was working on the book, and it was during that period that Oswald defected, and Thornley went, aha, I'm going to make him the main character and write this book based pretty much primarily on Oswald. Now, there's a lot of weird things about Otsugi Air Base, and one of them came out in a Rolling Stone article in, I think it was the late 70s, early 80s, that it had been a heavy CIA base and that they'd done a lot of the MKUltra and LSD experimentation there, which, you know, Thornley later became convinced he had been a victim of, and that both he and Oswald had been basically these type of MKUltra victim patsies, and Thornley went even so far as to suspect that he was like a set up to be a second patsy in the assassination if the Oswald setup hadn't gone down like it did.
Well, now that that brings up something that we haven't talked about. Are you familiar with the name Judith Vary Baker?
Yes, I did. It's interesting that you should mention her.
For those who don't know, if you're not familiar, folks, with the name Judith Vary Baker, this is a woman who has publicly stated, she has publicly claimed, that she was Oswald's girlfriend, mistress, and that Oswald was actually led to believe that he was doing things, all of his anti-Castro stuff and everything, was he was an agent, and that he was actually doing things to help bring about freedom in Cuba. And to shorten the story, her account is that Oswald was maneuvered into this this plot, which we are all familiar with, whether we think it's a conspiracy or we don't. We know the plot with Oswald in the school book depository. Now, during this period of time, Judith Vary Baker was a microbiologist working on a way to weaponize cancer so that it could be given to Castro, and then he would die very quickly and nobody in another country would be blamed for it. And according to her, she did get it perfected. So that's basically it in a nutshell. And have I left anything important out of that, Adam?
Well, here's what's interesting about that. Let me give you a little bit of background. A lot of the material I'm talking about is in my book, The Prankster and the Conspiracy, the story of Kerry Thornley. And since I wrote that book, I came across a lot more material regarding Kerry Thornley and Oswald and the Kennedy assassination. So I'm working on another book, and since my book came out, there's been a couple books that have come out that claim that Thornley was involved there in New Orleans, that he set up Oswald, or that he was some type of CIA operative. And one of the books mentions Kerry Thornley is Judith Vary Baker's book, Me and Lee, and she claimed that Thornley had an affair with Marina Oswald, which is kind of a bombshell. So what I'm doing right now is looking into some of these allegations and trying to get to the truth of the matter.
It sounds like, though, regardless of how this all comes down about Thornley, it sounds like the JFK assassination, from your point of view, was an MKUltra operation.
Well, it seems to point that way. There was some obvious manipulation, you know, as Judith Baker says in her book, that Oswald was being manipulated in New Orleans. Maybe, you know, he felt he was kind of an agent on a need-to-know basis. He was infiltrating communist groups there, had his own branch of the Fair Play for Cuba, but all of this ultimately looks like he was being set up by the band of people he was working with, the Guy Bannisters and David Ferries and all that bunch you see in the movie JFK. Ultimately, he was being set up, you know, when the assassination came down, that he could be painted as this lone nut communist sympathizer wacko. And so, you know, these are conversations people have been having for a long time, who've been looking into the JFK assassination, but it's something that's continued to interest me over the years. I think it was, you know, a crucial time in the history of, you know, our country and the planet as well, where, you know, JFK's assassination signaled a drastic change in the country that's been, in my opinion, spiraling down since then.
Well, and one factor that a lot of people either never knew or conveniently forget is that the assassination of JFK took Lyndon Johnson off the hook. He was about to be indicted on felony charges in connection with Billy Saul Estes down in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And the assassination made him president.
Yeah.
And all of that went away.
Yeah, a lot of people had things to gain, not only LBJ. I wasn't familiar with what you mentioned there, but, you know, you can just tick off a list of things that he was talking seriously about, getting out of Vietnam and dismantling the CIA and maybe even going after the Federal Reserve, this trying to be an agent of change, and perhaps hubris got the better of him.
He apparently had signed an executive order ordering the Federal Reserve to recall a large amount of their notes and ordering the U.S. Treasury to replace those notes with U.S. Treasury notes. The reason I say that's apparently what he did is because the very first official act of Lyndon Johnson after becoming president was to rescind that executive order. We'll be back right after this.
JSS member area since 2009. I really enjoy the fact that I have access to the K-Pods that are archived. I download them to my computer, put them on my MP3 player, and I can listen to them at my leisure on my long commute to and from work. I'd really like to see you in our community. It's only $6.95 per month, and it is worth far, far more. I sincerely hope you will join today.
Welcome back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Adam Gorightly. And Adam, when we stepped away for the break, we were talking about, I was talking about JFK having rescinded or having put out an executive order to recall a whole bunch of the funny money from the Federal Reserve and have it replaced with U.S. Treasury notes. And the first official act of Lyndon Johnson after being sworn in as president was to rescind that executive order, which was pretty curious. And but now, because you are so into this information, I know that you have probably heard of Daniel Sheehan. And Daniel Sheehan, or maybe he pronounces it Sheehan, has publicly named some names of people who were involved from his perspective, they were involved in the assassination of President Kennedy. And one of those names was really surprising for me, Clint Murchison. Clint Murchison, folks, was the first owner of the Dallas Cowboys.
Right. Yeah.
And the Murchison family were viewed virtually as gods in Dallas because of the Dallas Cowboys. And close friends with Tom Landry, the coach. What do you know about that? Is that real?
You know, it's one of the many, many names I've heard bandied about, but I couldn't say definitively one way or another. You know, it seems like there was a lot of people potentially involved with the assassination. I mean, a vast amount of orchestration had to go on between a lot of different entities, from the Secret Service to the FBI, CIA, Dallas Police, on and on. There's even stories of young George Bush, the first Bush president, being there in Dallas the day and Dealey Plaza the day of the assassination, as well as Richard Nixon was hovering around there. He was at a meeting with Pepsi Co. meeting the day before, and said he had left, but on the day of the assassination. But you know, one of the arguments: how could anybody pull off a conspiracy this vast and get away with it? I don't know, but seems.
Well,
like
they look. Let's think. That sounds. I hear that a lot too. I knew some of the people involved. I knew the police officer, J.D. Tippett.
You did?
Yes.
That's interesting.
Know the family well. I knew Oswald's landlady. Didn't know Oswald, knew nothing about him. Didn't even know that she was a landlady. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The deal is, she's the sister of someone that my parents went to church with. And so my parents, I was a little kid, my parents would, back then, I guess people still do this, they, after church on Sunday nights, sometimes would have certain members of the church as guests in our home, or we would be guests in their home. And so I've been a guest in the home of this lady who's the sister of Oswald's landlady, and she was there. And so I've met her, I've seen her, I've talked to her on numerous occasions. And there are some other minor players that I knew. I grew up in Dallas and grew up in the Oak Cliff section of Dallas where Oswald was living and where he was captured. Later, when I went into business, the Texas Theater has a penthouse office, and a lot of people don't know that. That was my office, and the Texas Theater is where Oswald was captured by the Dallas police. So, you know, I've been sort of swimming in this soup most of my life. But look, let's go back to the MK Ultra thing, because we hear, how could anything like this, if it really was such a big, grand conspiracy, how could they keep it covered up? Okay, let's think about how could they keep, testing LSD on unsuspecting U.S. citizens. How could they keep that a secret? Well, they did for a long time.
Yeah.
How could they keep it a secret that they infected a whole bunch of people down in South America with gonorrhea and on purpose, in order to do some testing, biological testing for our biological weapons knowledge bank? How could they do that and keep that a secret? Well, they did, and they kept it a secret up until, I guess, WikiLeaks released the information, and then they had to apologize. So how do they do it? Well, I think if you only look at Jim Garrison's investigation and look at the number of key witnesses that died mysteriously once he started the investigation, over 30.
Mm-hmm.
So how can they do it? Well,
yeah,
there you go.
Like that.
That's how you do it.
Let me share something with you a little bit, getting a little bit deeper into Thornley's involvement or alleged involvement or his relation to the Kennedy assassination. So he was in New Orleans in 61, you know, during that same period that Oswald was there, but he claimed he never saw Oswald. During that period, Thornley had moved after he got out of the Marines to New Orleans because he was a budding writer. He wanted to experience life and meet colorful characters, and he certainly did that in New Orleans. And a couple of guys he met went by the name of Slim Brooks, Roderick Slim Brooks, and Gary Kirsten. And Thornley spent a lot of time with these guys. They were a couple of kind of sketchy, interesting characters who claimed they had background in the intelligence agencies and worked with the mob and the underworld there in New Orleans. So Thornley had a lot of conversations, not unlike the ones he had had with Oswald, on politics and philosophy and different subjects. And at one point they engaged in a theoretical, at least it was a theoretical discussion to Thornley on how to kill a president, and in particular JFK. And like I said, at the time Thornley considered that nothing more than like a mental exercise, a theoretical discussion. But later these conversations, a decade later, would come back to haunt him. Let's talk a little bit about the Garrison investigation. That was started in 67, and we're all pretty familiar with that. One of the key witnesses Garrison indicted was Kerry Thornley. Garrison claimed, I think as I mentioned before, that he believed Thornley was some type of CIA agent. He was possibly one of the Oswalds. He believed that Thornley doctored the famous photo of, you've seen with Oswald in Dallas in front of a house or apartment building with the Manlike Carcano rifle in one hand and a communist manifesto of some sort in the other hand. Oswald later said that photo was doctored. Garrison claimed that Thornley doctored that photo, and it was actually a photo of Thornley with Oswald's head stuck on over his.
Mm-hmm.
And so the witnesses who came forward, few witnesses came forward claiming to see Oswald and Thornley together during that period. Once again, Thornley denied all of this. When Garrison's case against Clay Shaw was unsuccessful, he basically stepped back and he claimed that CIA had undermined his investigation. And so, at that point, Thornley was basically the case against him as well crumbled. In the early 70s, Thornley came across a book called Coup d'etat in America. You might be familiar, the acronym for the CIA, mm-hmm. written by the authors Alan Weberman and Michael Canfield. And in that book, it had the picture of the famous three tramps. They had come across those. Actually, the comedian Dick Gregory helped unearth those. And so they started examining those photos of the three tramp that were picked up in Daley Plaza right after the assassination. People are claiming they were gunmen or somehow involved. And they took those photos, and they took some overlay photos of folks involved in the Watergate burglary, namely E. Howard Hunt, and they matched them up to these tramps. Hunt, they matched up to the old man tramp, and he seemed to match perfectly. So Hunt, E. Howard Hunt, has became a figure a lot of people say was involved in the assassination. Actually gave that deathbed confession just a couple of years ago. He finally died. So anyway, Thornley, during this period, came across that book, and he saw the photo of E. Howard Hunt, and he goes, oh my God, that's the guy I had those conversations with in New Orleans back in 1961 about assassinating John F. Kennedy. And so when he made that realization, suddenly these memories started flooding back that indeed he had been manipulated. He'd been brainwashed to forget his involvement or participation in the JFK assassination. And this began a struggle for the rest of Thornley's life, looking into the assassination, trying to get to the bottom of it, figure out what his role was, and how he and Oswald were connected to all of this.
Okay, so did Thornley view himself as an anarchist?
Yes, he did. He viewed himself as a lot of things. He was a guy who went through a lot of changes throughout his life. He came across, like, you know, the period he was in the Marines, he came across the writings of Ayn Rand and became a big Randian follower. But he evolved his philosophy. He became, in the early 60s, a libertarian, and actually was the editor for one of the best and earliest libertarian newsletter. I forget the name off the top of my head, but he also got involved in the 60s counterculture, experimented with the free love. He was part of a mate-sharing tribe that also experimented with psychedelics. So he started evolving his libertarian philosophy and kind of merged it in.
Okay, Adam, we have to step away for break. Sorry about that. We'll pick up right there when we come back. Ladies and gentlemen, do not go away. More with Adam Gorightly right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Adam Gorightly, and we are talking at this point about Kerry Thornley and his possible role in the assassination of JFK. You were telling us that he was a follower of Ayn Rand, and that he was part of this free love movement, and also the experimentation with psychedelics. And then we had to go to break. You were in mid-sentence when we had to cut you off. So the mic is yours.
Yeah, got kind of long-winded there, but his politics, philosophies were always changing or evolving. So he started out involved in libertarianism, worked on that newsletter, and as you know, he got into the 60s, he started seeing that, you know, a lot of the folks in the libertarian movement there were very conservative, while a lot of his friends on the left were not so conservative, but a lot of the things they felt important, like, you know, freeing themselves from the constraints of government in, you know, its many forms. There was shared value. So he tried to bring the left and the right together, and also, you know, I guess you could term him as an anarcho-libertarian is what they're called. It's kind of a cross between libertarianism and anarchy, and, you know, I think a lot of people confuse anarchy sometimes as just people who throw bombs and destroy things, and I don't think that's really the intent of true anarchists. They're just more anti-government. And so Kerry, up until the end of his life, really the last 10, 15 years, came to, I think, what his true philosophy was kind of a combination of anarchy and Zen, and he called it Zenarchy, and he ended up publishing one of his last books was Zenarchy, published in the early 90s. Thornley died in 1998.
Did he ever get to the point where he was trying to recover these memories and come to terms with what his role may have been? Did he ever get to a point where he said, okay, here's what I did?
Well, it about drove him crazy. In fact, it did push him over the edge for many years, and he became, I think it might have led to a psychotic breakdown he had, and he became, you know, a lot of people thought he had become a paranoid schizophrenic, but if he'd been through everything he had, maybe we all would, too. He was constantly thought people were monitoring him, following him, shooting radio waves at his head, all of these things. You know, back in the 70s when he was talking about this, I think there's a little more acceptance for it now. They just thought he was out and out crazy as a, you know, coot. But if we'd been subjected to what he believed he'd been subjected to, his theories, though, you know, became more and more far out, and he, some confabulation might have crept in, but who knows? He thought one of his theories were that he and Thornley had been some type of Nazi breeding project, if you can believe that, and that all ties into the whole Project Paperclip thing, bringing the Nazi scientists over here, and you know, he's making the same connections that the late great conspiracy theorist May Brussel made about the whole Nazi intelligence apparatus, how it merged with the U.S. intelligence apparatus, and Thornley believed that he had been a pawn and a victim of that cryptocracy.
Well, that's not a conspiracy theory, that is a historical fact. It's a historical fact that the Nazi intelligence apparatus was merged with the intelligence apparatus of the United States of America. The entire Nazi intelligence corps was brought in and under the CIA, and their chief, I forget his name, general, was given. He was the head CIA guy for Eastern Europe.
I believe you're talking about Reinhold Gehlen.
That's it.
Yeah.
And that's a matter of historical fact. That's not a that's not a conspiracy theory. And folks, if you think it is, go check it out. It's a matter of historical fact.
And that's what I, you know, hope people do. Sometimes I don't try to come on too heavy, hoping they'll read my book and, you know, make your own, come to your own conclusions, you know, after you've weighed the evidence. You know, Thornley was onto this stuff long, you know, time ago before we had a lot of the information, you know, we've been privy to here in the last 20 years. He was making these connections, you know, way back in the mid-70s, and he thought, you know, all the assassinations were related with, he thought some of the same players involved in the JFK assassination were involved in Martin Luther King's murder and, you know.
All right, let me tell you something. Let me tell you something, and you may have an answer. You may have something here that would be of assistance to me.
Mm-hmm.
I told you that when I went into business at one point, my office was in the penthouse, which sounds elaborate. Believe me, the penthouse office at the Texas Theater is not elaborate. It's quite small. It was the only office they had available, and it was in a location where I needed to be. And so, but I was renting that office. At one point, I had bought a suit, and across the street from the Texas Theater, a tailor shop had opened up. It was a kind of a weird tailor shop because the windows, you know, were painted white from the inside. You could not see in. And so I needed to get this suit altered, and I took it across to this tailor shop. And when I walked in, there was a counter. And behind the counter, a few feet, there was a curtain. Not a wall, but a curtain. Now, this curtain was nothing but bed sheets hung on a wire. And I'm thinking, oh, I don't know about this. And then this guy comes from behind the curtain and wanted to know if he could help me, and I said, sure. And I put the suit up there. I told him what I needed done. He said, well, step back here and let's measure you. So I stepped behind the curtain, and behind the curtain was just open, empty store space. Nothing back there but a sewing machine, sort of a workspace desk, ironing board, and an iron. And this guy knew everything about me. He introduced himself as Sherman the tailor. He would have been at that time, he would have been maybe 50 to 55 years of age. He had graying, very curly hair. He was approximately 5 feet 9 inches tall. And I'll tell you the rest when we come back from this break. We'll be back, folks, right after this, so don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. We're glad you're here. My sincere sympathy to you for whatever it is that kept you away for the first hour. My guest this evening is Adam Go-Rightly. Sorry about that, Adam. Adam Go-Rightly. And he and I are talking about some of the strange and unexplained things that swirl about the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Some of you have been with us long enough that you have heard me say previously on other shows that I knew some of these people. I was a little kid when it happened, but I knew some of the people you've read about and heard about and related to the JFK assassination. I knew Officer J.D. Tippit and his family. In fact, I was at his funeral. I knew the landlady, Oswald's landlady, just an acquaintance, but I knew, I had met her and knew her, and some other more incidental people involved in that. But when we went away, I was telling you about Sherman the tailor. So this guy engages me in conversation and tells me a lot of stuff about me, which kind of unsettled me a little bit. And I asked him, I said, you know, you look familiar to me. I know I have seen you. He said, it's possible. And I said, where would I have seen you? He said, I was one of the federal prosecutors working on the assassination of Martin Luther King. And he said, what I started to uncover connected everything. It connected, and by this time we had Watergate already, so this was not right after the assassination. He said, let me tell you, he said, the assassination of Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, JFK, and Watergate are all connected. And he said, I'm just about to wrap this up. And he said, let me tell you, it's going to blow the lid right off of this.
Hmm.
All right, so a couple of days later, I came back, picked up my suit, and he had told me that in that first conversation, he had told me that because he was pressing forward with this investigation, they shut him down and told him, ordered him to stop the investigation. And so he had resigned and was doing this on his own now. And I said, well, how is it, if you're an attorney, how is it that you happen to know about how to be a tailor? He said, well, this is how I worked my way through law school. I said, oh, okay. He said he was an apprentice at a tailor shop and learned the trade while he worked his way through law school. So a couple of weeks later, I had another suit that I needed altered, and I went across the street, and there was a padlock on the door. And Sherman the tailor was gone. I never saw or heard from Sherman the tailor ever again. Does he or a figure like him ring any bells with you?
Perhaps. And I say that I'm currently working on this book about Thornley Oswald Kennedy assassination. And Thornley, it was in the mid-70s that he came across an investigation that looked like it was, these were federal investigators looking into it. It was kind of based out of Atlanta at that time, of course. That's kind of the was the stomping grounds of Martin Luther King. He was killed in Memphis, but looking into the same material, and I'll get deeper into this in the book. What year did you meet Sherman the Tailor?
I don't know. Look, this was Watergate had happened. Mm-hmm. Nixon was still president.
Okay.
He had not resigned. So, you know, I really can't be more specific about what year.
I will keep you posted as I look into this deeper. I have this whole file of material I'm working on here, and the plan is to get the book done for the next JFK assassination anniversary, which is coming up. What's that going to be? That'll be 50 years, man, here in 2013, if we make it to 2013, but
uh-huh.
I was
by the way, we will.
Yeah, oh, I think so, too. I'm not too worried.
Yeah.
pretty fascinating, you know, J.D. Tippit. For folks who've looked into the JFK assassination, I think it's like looking into a lot of the material on mind control and MKUltra. There's a lot of intentional disinformation that gets put out just to muddy the waters, to make everything irrelevant, you know, if you know what I mean. And
mm-hmm.
When I started looking into, I was pretty avid investigator into the JFK assassination, 20 years ago or so, reading all the books, and the deeper I got in down that rabbit hole, the more confusing I got to the point where I just had to step back. There was too much information, trying to separate the wheat from the chaff and make sense of it all. But one of the more bizarre JFK assassination theories came from a guy named George Thompson. And he came up with this in the mid-60s. He was writing, he did, it was like a self-published series of newsletters he put out, and he claimed that, well, JFK wasn't actually killed. It was J.D. Tippit in his place, and that the the main assassin in Daley Plaza there with a machine gun was Lyndon B. Johnson. And so these theories of Tippit, there's other people who've came out with them. I think Robert Morningstar was one, and claiming there had been some type of switch there. This researcher, George C. Thompson, once again claimed that Kennedy never died, and they placed, basically used Tippit in his place. Pretty far-out theory, but if you look at the photos, at least the photos I've seen of Tippit and JFK, they do look similar. What do you think about all this craziness?
Well, I think it's possible. I will say that the at the funeral of J.D. Tippit, I was a little kid. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they opened the casket or not at the funeral. I think they did not. J.D. Tippit used to be kidded by fellow officers. They would call him Jack. Mm-hmm. Because he looked a lot like President Kennedy, whose nickname, of course, was Jack. And so they would call him Jack. He apparently had friendly relations with Jack Ruby. There's some indications that he frequented the club. And, you know, it's entirely possible that John Kennedy's body was not John Kennedy, but J.D. Tippit. Jacqueline Kennedy commented to Bobby when she saw John Kennedy in the casket, "It doesn't even look like him." So it's possible. I have to say that it's a possibility. The doctor who was the pathologist, chief pathologist for Dallas County at that time, drew, and listen, they handled gunshot victims all the time. This guy was a pro. He was known around the country as one of the best. And he drew his sketches of the wounds and so forth, and they don't match the wounds that were on the body of Jack Kennedy at Bethesda Hospital. And so is it possible that there was a switch? It's possible, because the FBI came in, or the Secret Service, I forget which one, and said, okay, we're going to take him. And he said, now, wait a minute. This murder happened in Dallas County. I have jurisdiction. The autopsy must be done here. And at gunpoint, they took him out of the hospital, loaded him on the plane, and the plane has missing time between Dallas and Bethesda.
Yeah, there was a recent that Kennedy television series, and I just saw parts of it. I forget if it was on PBS or whatever. Talked about that, and it was the Secret Service who basically took off with the body of whoever it was. We assume it was JFK, much, you know, to the objection of the Dallas police. Very bizarre situation there that went down.
There was a lady who was an eyewitness to the killing of Tippit, and the description she gave does not match Oswald.
Mm-hmm.
She said he looked Cuban. And
those Cuban people who look Cuban pop up again and again in a lot of these assassination capers.
Well, Frank Sturgis, of course. Frank Sturgis was one of the big Watergate burglars. That's not his name. His name is Fiorno.
Yeah.
Or Fiorni. And he was a general over Castro's Air Force. He was a double agent CIA. And, you know, so Bay of Pigs went south. Didn't work. Everybody involved with that was upset. The mafia was upset because they were going to get, if it worked, they were going to get control of Cuba again. And so they were upset. The Federal Reserve was upset. Everybody, J. Edgar Hoover hated the Kennedys, and they hated him. So, I mean, that's the problem is there were so many people, so many big players who wanted Kennedy out of the picture that it's hard to know which direction to look, and maybe looking in all those directions is correct.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, you mentioned the Bay of Pigs and Frank Sturgis involved with Watergate, and he was also identified, some people have identified him as one of those three tramps in Dealey Plaza.
Have you, are you familiar with a book called Plausible Denial?
It rings a bell. Who wrote that one?
I'm trying to remember the name. I can't remember his name, but let me tell you who he is. When Oswald was charged with the assassination, he was appointed an attorney. This attorney never got to talk to Oswald. Oswald was killed before he had a chance to talk to him. Okay, now, whenever E. Howard Hunt was identified as one of those three tramps, there was a newspaper out in California that ran with the story, and they really put it out there, and he sued them.
Yeah.
And this attorney volunteered to represent that newspaper pro bono. So this is the only actual court case having to do with, you know, the real players involved in the Kennedy assassination. And
I
he won.
I think you're talking about Mark Lane, right?
That's it.
Yeah.
And Mark Lane won the case.
Mm-hmm.
And by winning the case, he proved, in order to win the case, he proved that E. Howard Hunt was exactly who he had been identified as. He was one of the hobos, and he was there, and one of the players. He, in his book, and this is interesting, in his book, he published a memo telling it was a memo that, a government memo, that George Bush had been informed of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And this, some people have identified as George H.W. Bush, Herbert Walker,
right,
the old guy now. Others have said this was a different CIA agent by the name of George Bush. However, it's interesting that the Bay of Pigs operation, they had two refitted, formerly mothballed U.S. Navy ships. One of those ships they christened the Barbara, and one of them they christened Zapata. George H. Bush, his oil company was the Zapata Oil Company, and his wife was Barbara. Coincidence? Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. I can't say it's not a coincidence, but it certainly is worthy of raising one eyebrow and at least saying, hmm.
Oh, certainly. And, you know, if Bush had never been involved with the CIA, how did he end up being the director of the CIA under Richard Nixon? That kind of came out of the blue.
He did testify at his confirmation hearings that he had no prior involvement with the CIA. That is true. He did testify to that. They did not challenge that. But then here comes Mark Lane's book with this memo linking a George Bush to the CIA. And, of course, they've never identified who is this other George Bush. And they can get away with that. They can say, well, you know, we can't give that information out. People's lives are at stake.
Yeah, they basically identified that other George Bush as some lowly clerk that they could provide no real information on. So, yeah, it smells to me.
Well, if he's just a lowly clerk, why is there this memo that is talking about informing George Bush of this operation?
Right. Good point.
You know. Now, it's also true that the only president that we have had, there are two presidents, actually, that we've had since World War II, who were not members of the Council for Foreign Relations. John Kennedy was one, and the other one was Ronald Reagan. However, Ronald Reagan, I was less than 10 feet away from Reagan in a press conference when he was running for president. And he and George Bush were at each other's throats. And polar opposites. But when he won the nomination, it was a surprise to everyone that he named George Bush as his running mate. At that point in history, George Herbert Walker Bush was the chairman of the board of directors of the Council for Foreign Relations. He was the top guy at CFR. And he resigned that position in order to run with Reagan. So, you know, the real movers and shakers behind the scenes that really are running the country appear to be the CFR people. They're the kingmakers.
Mm-hmm.
Reagan was too popular for them to handle, too hot to handle. They couldn't get their guy over the hump, but they did get him on the ticket.
Well, Dick Gregory, conspiracy researcher, comedian, made the joke. Reagan in 80, Bush in 81, after that assassination attempt or whatever it was, that once again you look into all that with John Hinckley and he appeared to be another MKUltra type. I've written a bit about that over the years, how they found The Catcher in the Rye in his presence, of the same book they found on Mark David Chapman, like it was some type of programming type of tool. And as I recall, there was some meeting between now I'm confusing a couple of different things, but meeting with one of the Bushes with Mark David Chapman's father prior to Lenin's assassination. So when you start going down these rabbit holes, my God, connections you find. I've been making a few notes as we've progressed along. E. Howard Hunt, I should mention. I was talking about Atsugi Air Base in Japan, where both Oswald and Thornley served, and the Rolling Stone magazine claimed MKUltra operations were going on there, LSD experimentation. And in E. Howard Hunt's biography, he notes that he was stationed at Atsugi Air Base during the same period. Coincidence? You talked about Judith Very Baker's book about how she was cooking up at the behest of our government certain cancer agents they could use on Fidel Castro, and that's the same thing that Jack Ruby claimed did away with him quickly, a fast-acting cancer, when he had come out at one point and claimed that there was an assassination conspiracy in JFK's offing.
Yeah, that's true.
And I wanted to mention one more thing. My notes here doubles. We talked about, the Tippit Kennedy thing, and also there was all these Oswald doubles. Gerson claimed that Thornley was an Oswald double, but it appeared, if you look into the case of Lee Harvey Oswald, you're talking about, who was it? Jackie said that it wasn't JFK in his casket.
Yeah, that's when we were talking about the possibility that Tippit's body was in the JFK casket.
Yeah. Marguerite Oswald, Oswald's mother, claimed that it wasn't her son buried there, wherever he was laid to rest. I'm not sure if that was Dallas or whatever.
Yeah, in Fort Worth.
She claimed that a different Oswald came back from Russia than her son that went there. And if you look, it's pretty interesting, if you look at photos of Oswald before he went to Russia and after, they don't... they look similar, but I don't think they look like the same cat.
Yeah, it's also pretty interesting. You know, when he defected, he walked into the U.S. Embassy, handed the ambassador his passport, and said, "I'm defecting. I'm leaving the United States citizenship behind, and I renounce my citizenship." They put his passport in the desk drawer. 2 years later, when he came back and said, I want to come back to the United States, they reached into that desk drawer and handed him that passport back.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you or I or anybody else walks into a U.S. embassy and hands them a U.S. passport and says, I renounce my citizenship, they hand you a form that you sign, and that's it, done deal, and your passport gets canceled. And you're no longer a citizen. So, there are all kinds of mysteries about this individual called Oswald. One of the most interesting documentaries I've ever seen is called The Many Faces of Oswald.
Hmm.
And this guy, whoever it is, shows a lot of different photographs and the photo analysis, and there are different Oswalds. We have to step away for break. We'll be back right after this, and when we come back, we will open up the telephone lines.
Radio like nowhere else on earth.
To the Kevin Smith Show. My guest, Adam Gorightly. And Adam, what I want to do is open up the telephone lines and invite our audience to join us and participate in tonight's discussion. Folks, the thing that's behind this that falls into the genre of the strange and the unexplained is this whole thing about MK Ultra. Mind control, and how effective is it? Now, we know for sure that MK Ultra existed. It's supposed to be out of business, but I've had guests, Adam, who have told me they simply changed the name, moved it to another agency, put it further underground, and it's still going on. I don't know if that's the case. I have no way of knowing whether that's true or not, but we know MK Ultra existed because of the church committee hearings, the Senate committee hearings, that drilled into this and absolutely scalded the CIA and documented that this program did exist. So actually it's not a program, it's many programs under an umbrella called MKUltra.
Yeah.
And MK stands for the German, interestingly, the German words for mind control. So,
and after those congressional investigations you talk about where a lot of this stuff came to light, according to things I've heard and read, a lot of the files were destroyed.
Yeah. Well, that's what they say. All they have to do is move them somewhere else and say they were destroyed. NASA moved a whole bunch of their data to Australia. Their data about the first moon mission, the first moon landing.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of their data and the tapes with the photographs and so forth, and tapes with the telemetry on it. They moved it to Australia. And then they said, well, we've lost them. We don't know where they are. People in Australia, not knowing they were supposed to play the game, said, oh, we found them. They were stored under this in this storage shed under the stadium seats over here. And so here they are. We found them. And that put NASA kind of on the spot. But all you got to do is move them and say we destroyed them. And even if you destroyed them, you can't get them all. So,
and with the mind control stuff, I mean, God, I've interviewed people, and there's hundreds, thousands of people telling these stories that it's still going on today. Granted, some of these people might be delusional, a percentage of them. Some might be spreading disinformation to muddy the waters, but I mean, it's this tear endless stories to this day. It's getting, it became, you know, more insidious and more technologically sophisticated.
Let me give our telephone number out. Folks, the telephone number here is a magic number. I think you know that. It has magical powers. On the level of Star Trek, because if you put these numbers into your little device called a telephone, it will transport you here to the studio. Okay? Here are the numbers. This is the galactic combination for being transported to the studio. 623-444-5889. 623-444-5889. If you are in the USA or Canada, please use those numbers. If you're anywhere else in the galaxy, that number will work. However, we recognize that international long-distance calls are expensive. So if you're outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, we have something just for you. It's called a flash message option on the website. Just go to the website, kevinsmithshow.com, scroll down till you see the picture about tonight's show. Right above that picture is a flash message link. All right? So we want you to participate as well, wherever you happen to be, scattered across this planet in the 143 countries listening to the show. And we've made it possible for you to participate without it costing you anything. All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, my name is Charlotte. I'm calling from Silver Spring.
Okay, Charlotte from where?
Silver Spring, Maryland.
Hello, Charlotte.
Yeah, I have Judith Barry Baker's book, and when you were talking about Thornley, I was really interested because he's mentioned a couple of times. And the Warren Commission was aware of him. They said that neighbors testified that Thornley was there so often they were unsure as to which one was Oswald or Thornley. So that could be one reason why some people thought there was more than one Oswald. But the Oswald that is in this book was known by everyone around him from childhood, it seems like. David Ferry had known him in the Civil Air Patrol when he was 17 or so, and the landlady that Judith lived with had known Lee Harvey Oswald from childhood. So kind of interesting because on one hand you said that he seemed like a different person after he came back from Russia, and yet there's a continuity about the individual. So,
yeah, it was his mother said that.
It was
his mother that said that's not the same Lee Harvey Oswald.
And yet all these other people around him didn't seem to notice that different. His Russian was remarkable. He spoke Russian almost like a native.
Russian. Yeah. Adam, you have a comment? Well, Adam has been cut off, it would appear. How about that? We'll attempt to get him back on the line.
The Oswald that she's describing here does seem to be an individual.
Let's say that that this Oswald. Well, while I'm talking to you, I'm trying to get him back on the line with us. Let's say that this Oswald who came back. Can you hear that? Can you hear the dial tone?
Yes, I can.
I dial the number and it just gives me a dial tone after I dial the number. Interesting. This Oswald that came back from Russia might have been physically the same person, but vastly changed in his personality and character. That could be what his mother's referring to.
Yeah.
It could also be it's not the same physical person, looks a lot like him, and in many ways acts like him, but only a mother would know. It could be that as well. So I don't know. Charlotte, do you have children?
No.
Okay. You have nieces, nephews?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. You would notice a difference, a slight difference, if one of those nieces or nephews got switched out, and the new one was really a good actor and looked a lot like, maybe exactly like the other one, but you would notice a slight difference before friends would.
Well, I know what you're getting at. But another interesting thing is he had a mastoid, a mastoiditis operation as a child. And that leaves a very unique kind of scar behind the ear.
Uh-huh.
And the Lee Harvey Oswald that, and she only called him Lee Oswald, she didn't call him Lee Harvey, Lee Oswald that Judith Baker knew had that scar behind his ear.
So she thinks it's the real one.
She's saying, though, he could have been mentally changed.
Mm-hmm. We have Adam back on the line if you have a question for him.
I am here.
Yeah, so Charlotte, if you have a question for Adam, go ahead with it. We got him back on the line.
It wasn't a question. It was more just a comment that in the book by Judith Ferry Baker, Lee Harvey Oswald is described as, well, he was known by many of the people that she knew from childhood, and I guess that was basically what I was wondering about, if there was really a change of the individual or just perhaps a mental change after he came back from Russia, because he had an operation on his ear as a child and the scar was still there and she saw it. And David Ferry had known Oswald at 17 or 18 and still knew the same person, so... It just seems like this individual just being described in New Orleans in 1963 summer was the same Oswald that grew up there. That's, I guess, basically what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Could very well be. And I'm just basing that on looking at those photos. And once again, looking at the photos before Russia and after Russia, I saw some difference. But, you know, we all age and change. But it's... definitely seems a curiosity to me, at least, along with
one thing I do believe, though, is Robert, your idea, and I think also Robert Morningstar, that there may have been a change in the bodies between Tippit and Kennedy. That was really kind of remarkable when he laid out that theory. That was very
indeed, convincing. Indeed, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that Kevin testifies to that he actually knew J.D. Tippit, and they his friends called him Jack because he looked so much like JFK. Pretty interesting.
Yeah.
I really had a very, very different idea of Oswald after reading this book. I'd never had believed, really, that he was the assassin anyway, but after reading this book, he did emerge as a very, very interesting individual.
Well, you know, whether you come away from Judith Baker's book thinking, as she does, that Oswald was actually a patriot and that he had nothing at all to do with the assassination.
Well,
he didn't
say,
you know,
that. She doesn't say he had nothing to do with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, she does. She says he was not a trigger man. And
right, right.
He was an infiltrator and got maneuvered into the position he was in and couldn't get out of it because they threatened to kill his wife and kids. And but he was not a player in the assassination. So if you come away from it thinking that he was a patriot, like she thinks, or you come away from it thinking
yes,
he was a conspirator.
I mean, Oxner said that about him.
If you come away from it thinking he was a conspirator, either way, you have to come away from this understanding, I think, that all the evidence shows he was the patsy.
Yeah.
He was the fall guy. Yeah. Hey, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. All right. 623-444-5889. 623-444-5889. And we'd love to hear from you. We've had a number of folks on this show, Adam, who have said that they were victims of the MK Ultra programs. A couple of them, super soldier guys, and... Mm-hmm. You know, they said that they were subjected to this from the time they were little kids and really had no choice. They just kind of got inducted into it. All right, we're going to step away for break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest, Adam Gorightly, and Adam got cut off just a little while ago. Let's just check and see. Are you still with me, Adam?
Yes, I am.
All right. Let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. It's Debbie from Columbus.
Yeah, Debbie.
Interesting talk tonight. I just wanted to kind of make a statement. I'm sure we all know why JFK was assassinated, and that's because he was ready to spill the beans about UFOs.
Well, that's that is one reason.
And
there are many others.
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, that is one of many. But, you know, of course, the government could have him doing that, so they had to silence him.
And now that you've said that on international radio, you're on a watch list. You know that.
Oh, well, I'm sure I have been because, you know, me, I've been talking about UFOs and the like for many years now, and it doesn't scare me. I told you that one time, Kevin, about the men in black following me and my buddies when we got back from camping.
Yeah.
So they don't scare me.
Well, let's see what Adam has to say about the UFO angle. Debbie, thanks for the call. What about that? I'm sure you've heard that.
I have heard that, and that it was, you know, nothing definitive I've heard. I was going to ask Debbie, you know, what's the source for this? What do you base that on? I know that there was a book written a few years back that there had been pillow talk between Marilyn and JFK about that subject of UFOs, and he claimed some knowledge thereof, but I don't know anything more than that.
Okay. We have a flash message from, I think it's pronounced Greg, and this is from Sweden. So much evil, so much deception. How can you Americans stand the living?
That's a heavy question there.
Well, my answer is no choice. What's your answer, Adam?
Where there's life, there's hope. That sounds pretty trite. You know, there is a lot of craziness and insanity in the world, but I, you know, have a lot of friends and have had a lot of good times and continue to, you know, keep on keeping on, as they say, doing the things that interest me. And so, I don't know, I find life exciting, challenging, and we just need to make as much sense of the madness as we can.
You know, what I can say about the this comment, so much evil, so much deception. I've lived all around the world, and I haven't lived in every country. I'm not saying that, but I have lived in, worked in, and spent time visiting in some 30 countries. I haven't found one where the politics is devoid of evil and deception.
Right.
There are times in every country where evil and deception seems to be the norm in their politics. And there are times in every country where truth and goodness seems to be the norm in their politics. The United States of America is just like every other country in that respect. However, being so rich and powerful, it's so visible. And it's much more visible than you would find in smaller countries where it's easier to hide it. It's true. Evil and deception has momentum right now. The Mo is with that team and has been for a while.
Yeah, the Mo is with the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower talked about and that Kennedy challenged at some level, and I think, you know, that's one of the main reasons he went down. It's become such a corporate, global thing. It's beyond the United States, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's a worldwide network of people who don't care about, really, ultimately, about the flags or the countries. It's, you know, concerned about making a profit, and it's, you know, they might use the illusion of countries and nationalism and those type of things, but it has nothing to do with that. It has to do with, you know, manipulating the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. That is true. It's all about power. It's all about profit. And I have one more thing to say about that, and that is that evil and corruption eventually eats itself.
Mm-hmm.
The Soviet Union fell apart under the weight of its own corruption. And there are people who want to take credit for or give credit to various others for having brought about the demise of the Soviet Union. But in the final analysis, the Soviet Union fell apart under the weight of its own corruption. And this has been the case of every empire in the history of the world. And that is what is happening as I speak to the power structures in the United States.
Yeah, exactly.
It's beginning to crumble under the weight of its own corruption.
Much like, you know, we're a mirror image of the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
We have our fingers into all kinds of stuff all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
It just becomes too big and unwieldy to support itself.
Well, it does if it was built on deception. Because mm-hmm. once you tell a lie, you got to tell another one to support it, and another one to cover that, and another one to cover that. And after a while, you can't manage the lies. And, you know, when you do that on an international scale, it gets to a point rather quickly where you're pretty much standing naked in front of the world and they know what you are. And that's, I think, what's happened. I think that's what we're witnessing that right now. And that is not to say that I'm anti-American. I'm not. I'm very pro-American. Mm-hmm. But I'm on the other team. I'm on the team that likes truth and goodness. And, you know, the team that's got the mo right now, they're ahead on the scoreboard. But the momentum is beginning to slow down. And that means that it will soon shift across the line, and the momentum will be in the camp of those who like truth and goodness and liberty. So the momentum will shift. And
I hope you're right.
Oh, I'm absolutely certain I am. History says that's what happens. The only thing is, they can, if they are mean and nasty enough, they can bring down the United States as they fall. But something else will rise in its place. And there's a lot of good people in this country. People that love the country. They love freedom, love liberty, love the Constitution. And pretty much have a leave me alone, live and let live attitude about interfering in other people's problems. Interfering in other people's countries. Most people in this country really don't support that. Adam, I want to thank you for being with me. Stay on the line, and we will talk here in just a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to be it. That's a wrap for tonight, and I hope you've enjoyed tonight's show. Click Adam's picture on my website. It'll take you over to his website. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.